I'm Leonard Lopate, and this is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. A new exhibit of Salvador Dali's work opened recently at the Philadelphia Museum of Art. Over 200 pieces are displayed in the first retrospective since the Museum of Modern Art showcased him in 1941. The eccentric artist lived his life as art and crossed all genres, not only painting, but also sculpture, film, advertising, jewelry, clothes, interior design, and furniture. Michael Taylor is the curator of the exhibition. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show.
Great to be here.
Is it relevant to know where Dali was born?
I think increasingly so. Mainly because having done the research for the show over the past 5 years and gone to see where he grew up, which is around the area of Cadaqués on the Costa Brava, you realize that so many of his paintings, the backgrounds are that side of Spain, the Mediterranean light, the beaches, the rocks. It's an extraordinary landscape that actually affected him.
Any other important artists come out of that area?
Not many. I mean, I think that the main trade there is sort of fishing. And so Dali's friends were sort of fishermen, and there was a sort of sense, I think, that Dali was the sort of the strange one in the community, the one who actually went to Madrid and studied art.
Of course, he was the strange one once he wound up in Madrid and Paris and everywhere he went. Did his family encourage his interest in art?
They tolerated it. His father was a notary, which was quite an important... he was an important man in the town, and I think that he wanted his son to enjoy himself and experiment with art, but I think he always felt that he could never have a career. And in fact, when Dali started selling his paintings, his father didn't believe him.
Well, his work doesn't seem to be typical of Spanish art. It doesn't grow out of Velázquez or Zurbarán or Murillo or Goya or any of the other greats of the past, and definitely not out of the important modern artists like Picasso. So where did this anomalous style come from?
I would say mainly from magazines. Dali, as a student, I mean, he admired all those artists that you mentioned, but he was also intensely modern. And to study in Madrid in the early 1920s was to be cut off from Paris and the mainstream of modern art. Now, he had an uncle, Uncle Anselmo Domenech in Barcelona, who was a book dealer, and would send Dali all the latest magazines, surrealist magazines, Le Corbusier's L'Esprit Nouveau, Valore Plastici, the great futurist magazine. And Dali would often copy those paintings and make them into his own. So he's a very eclectic artist from an early age.
But he was also a rarity in modern art because his work was so influenced by the art of the past, and storytelling was such an important factor in his work.
Yeah. I would say if you were to sort of hold a gun to his head at that early moment in the sort of 20s, I think he would have said that his favorite artist was Vermeer. I mean, I think the detailed illusionism, which is there from the very start when he's a teenager, I think that's sort of what he called hand-done color photography came right out of Vermeer, so not Spanish art.
And he cited Vermeer throughout his life, talked about those glorious reds that he hoped to duplicate sometime. He's usually called a surrealist, but wasn't he kicked out of the surrealist movement by André Breton?
He was, yeah.
Why?
Well, he joins the surrealist group at a funny time. The surrealists were all sort of in rancor. This is around 1929, and Breton was expelling everyone. And Dali, for a while, had a big impression on Breton and the artists of the group, because he sort of, that detailed realism began to replace the abstraction of Arp and Masson. But as the decade went on, Dali's antics, his extracurricular antics, where, you know, he's upsetting people and getting interest in dodgy politics, I think all of these things, he was never really someone to toe the party line. He was too individual, and Breton expelled him.
Well, Breton was a communist.
Yep.
But you're saying that his detailed realism actually fit in with the way things were going, because communism was then moving into the Stalinist phase, where we had social realists, the abstraction of the post-Soviet revolution was outlawed, so that may be one factor. But also, wasn't surrealism changing into something where there was much more interest in Freud and
Correct.
The whole matter of dreams? And Dali plays into that perfectly, doesn't he?
Yeah, I mean, Freud's interpretation of dreams had been published in Spanish in 1922. In other words, before the French surrealists had read it, Dali was very well aware of it. And he actually had a profound understanding of Freud. I mean, I think Dali's great contribution was to reinvigorate the surrealist movement through a kind of Freudian language of symbols. You know, the lion can be Dali's notary father who, you know, had a bellowing voice, and he would always have sort of jug women to represent his mother. These sort of psychosexual Oedipal dramas that Dali makes around about 1929 were exhilarating to Breton because they were so easy to decode if you knew the language. And Bataille in Documents does a wonderful diagram of a Dali painting called The Lugubrious Game. And I think that side of Dali, that sort of in many respects sort of offering you visual puzzles to decode through Freudian psychoanalysis, for a time, I think, changed the course of surrealism. But as you say, that I think as surrealism moved further and further towards a dogmatic role in line with the French Communist Party, so Dali's behavior and his kind of strange sort of attitude to life, you know, his jokes, if you will, and the way he didn't take things seriously at a highly serious time, fascism is coming, I think became increasingly problematic.
And he did, was able to live with Franco in Franco Spain, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, during the Spanish Civil War, Dali has an apolitical view. He wants to be like Goya. He wants to have a cold sort of clinical detachment. He felt, unlike Picasso, whose great Guernica had sort of decried the atrocities of Franco's troops and the bombing by German warplanes on the Basque capital, Dali, I think, on the other hand, felt that there are atrocities on both sides. And he sort of saw it as being, the Spanish Civil War was almost a part of the Spanish temperament. And it was within all of the Spanish people, they were sort of pulling themselves apart. There's a wonderful painting called Soft Construction with Boiled Beans that sort of demonstrates Spain in a state of sort of auto-strangulation.
Well, there were other factors. First of all, the surrealists were very anti-bourgeois. Yeah. And here we have Dali really obsessed by getting publicity.
And money.
Moving more and more into commercialism. He probably represented everything that they hated, to the point where Breton actually coined an anagram based on the spelling of his name, Avida Dollars.
Yes, hungry for dollars. Well, Dali loved that anagram because he thought it was true. I mean, Dali, he would always cite Cervantes as his great sort of role model, and also the model of someone who he didn't want to be like, because despite the success of Don Quixote, Cervantes dies in a debtor prison. And Dali always had this idea that fame and money were really what made a great artist. And he never really hid that. I mean, he was quite open about it. That is reprehensive to anyone who's a sort of hardline modernist.
Well, how much of this came out of his own attitudes, and how much was the influence of Gala?
Well, Gala, I think, was very important in all this. You know, there's a big question mark. Warhol, who admired Dali's work, always said, you know, one wonders what would have happened to Dali if he hadn't have painted those soft watches and hadn't have met Gala. I don't think we can answer that question, but I think one of the things that's clear is that when Gala enters his life again in that key year of 1929, she sort of makes him a much more disciplined artist. I mean, from now on, Dali will have a routine. He paints during the summer months and he exhibits during the winter months. And I think she liked money, and I think that she liked prestige and fame, and she ditched a lot of famous artists before Dali. But really, she stuck with him because she really felt that he was the greatest artist of the 20th century.
Well, Gala sometimes called his lifelong companion, sometimes his wife.
Yeah.
Did they ever get married?
Twice. They got married in 1934. But she was
much older than he was.
She was 10 years older, and she was also married to the surrealist poet Paul Éluard. So that first marriage wasn't an official one. And Dali actually, in 1949, having converted back to Catholicism, goes to see the Pope. and presents him with a picture, and his real reason for going is to get special dispensation to marry Gala. And in the spirit of a holy year, the Pope actually blessed the painting but refused the marriage. And it was only when Paul Éluard died in 1952 that Dali and Gala were able to have a religious ceremony and get married again.
But theirs does seem like an odd relationship, except for the fact that she was his muse.
Very odd.
There's ambiguous sexuality there, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, Dali had a great fear of the sexual act. He always put it down to his father. His father's way of teaching him about the birds and the bees was to leave on the piano, where he knew his impressionable son would find it, a textbook on venereal diseases. So you can imagine what that did. So he immediately associated sex with basically disease and death. And Gala, I think, was someone who was, you know, fairly free with her sexuality. And I think the two of them, there's something about their relationship. Dali's voyeurism and Gala's, for want of a better word, nymphomania, they somehow clicked. And I think they stayed together because they were sort of mutually interested in different things.
How much of this can we actually read into the paintings?
Oh, quite a bit. I mean, I think that Dali's great discovery of Freud meant that it meant laying everything out. And I think Dali's paintings, after a certain moment, say 1929, are really infused with his desires, his fears. I think his kind of sexual hang-ups are there for everyone to see.
Well, he became an international superstar, but I think it's fair to say that most critics and most artists never really embraced him.
I think that's very true. I mean, I think that Dali today, I think, looks very different to the way he looked, say, in 1941. You mentioned the Museum of Modern Art's retrospective, the last time there was a retrospective in this country. I think that Dali was an artist who saw no distinction between high and low culture, and he was interested in expanding his fame. So he would do jewelry, perfume, a line of ties, and he would get criticized for it, and because artists at that time were meant to be pure and abstract.
But he also had this eccentric, clownish side. It was quite apparent that he was self-promoting. In a way, he might have been anticipating pop culture and pop art culture.
And I think that's why artists from Warhol to Matthew Barney and Jeff Koons, they've all kind of looked at him in a different way, I think, to the critics. I think the critics want to put him in a box and say that there's a great Dali from 1929 to 1939, but once he leaves surrealism, it's all over. And I think that artists are always ahead of the critics, and I think that the way in which Dali's work now seems so fresh and contemporary is due to the fact that Dali never really gave up, and he always felt, even if, you know, it wasn't always true, he always felt that each year he was going to have the next great idea that was going to change art.
But he also probably was disdained because he appealed mostly to people who didn't like modern art, people who would go through the Museum of Modern Art and make contemptuous remarks about the Picassos and the abstract paintings, and, here's something that I can relate to.
Yeah, I mean, I think Dali's a complex artist.
I mean, was he too accessible, or were people just reading the wrong things into him at the time?
I don't know. I mean, I think it's, in hindsight, it's easy to say people were wrong. I mean, I think that you had to be living in the 30s when Dali's great fame came. And, I mean, Dali has an exhibition in 1939 at the Julian Levy Gallery, and his paintings are so popular that people are lining up around the streets. His paintings are being compared to Whistler's Mother. And I think that that's the high point. The low point, I think, is in the late 40s when he can't sell anything.
But although then later he just banged out those prints and made a lot of people very happy, some people do think that it's fitting that the Dali Museum is located in St. Petersburg, Florida. On the other hand, you're making a case for us to reassess him. What would you like us to see here that we haven't been seeing since 1941? Except for the few artists like Warhol, Matthew Barney, and Jeff Koons, and I'm sure there are three or four others in the neo school of Dali.
Yeah. I would like people to come to this exhibition with an open mind and an open heart and to look at the work again. I think that we've only... Dali's an artist. You know him for his moustache. You know him for his antics. He was a terrific self-promoter. But we're going to be showing early paintings that reveal his skill as a draftsman, his real sort of sense of exploration of the avant-garde. And then later on, I think his experiments with optical illusions... And with a kind of, you know, it only Dali in 1973 could hook up with Alice Cooper and make a hologram. You know, there's the inquisitive nature of Dali, his interest in science and technology. These are all things that I think are very contemporary now.
Well, he hooked up with filmmakers as well.
Yeah.
And when I think about the dream sequences that he did then, very Dali-esque, I wonder what would have happened if he had lived in the time of computer-generated imagery, CGI. I suspect that there are a lot of filmmakers right now who look back at those old Dali paintings and duplicate them.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, and Dali, one of the things that I think is always worth pointing out with Dali is that he had a habit of finding the right people. You know, Luis Buñuel, Lorca, in films. I mean, Hitchcock, Disney, these are the people he gravitated towards.
But he made a movie with Luis Buñuel as well.
He made two movies, yeah. And they actually went to school together in Madrid. And actually, I mean, when Dali wanted to make a film of his life story in 1966, he went to Fellini. And Fellini actually didn't want to do it. He had too many ideas of his own. But I think what I'm trying to say is that he always had a kind of inkling as to who was the most interesting and original and innovative film director at that time.
Well, I would have seen Fellini as a mm-hmm. kindred spirit, and I'm yeah. sure Dali did it as well.
I think he did. He admired his movie.
So is this show, you say, will have a lot of surprises? Will it also include the greatest hits?
Oh, yeah.
And the melting watches and stuff and the people whose insides are drawers.
Yeah, I mean, even if you have no truck for his very large late paintings, which often fuse science and religion, what Dali called nuclear mysticism. And even if you're kind of only there as a surrealist fan and you're not going to look at anything after 1939, there's enough there for you. I mean, there's over 200 works in the show.
Including installation pieces.
Mm.
Was he an innovator there, or was he somebody who saw things happening and immediately understood that these were interesting ways for art to go?
I think Dali thought that whatever he touched would be golden. And I think that he always brought that amazing sort of what he called the paranoid critical method.
He loved that word, paranoid.
He did. His way of sort of thinking applied to furniture, telephones, designs for the ballet, an interior based on Mae West's lips, where he makes a sofa. I mean, it didn't matter what Dali did. He felt that it would be stunning and kind of, you know, what you see there again is he's a polymath artist, almost in the sense of Leonardo.
Well, he is playful, and that's something mm-hmm. that sometimes rubs people the wrong way.
Yeah.
Until they realize that playfulness can sometimes have a deeper side. Michael Taylor is the curator of Salvador Dali, now at the Philadelphia Museum. That's at Benjamin Franklin Parkway at 26th Street. If you take the train down to Philadelphia, it's just a short walk over a little bridge.
That's right.
Thank you so much for being with
us. Thank you. We'll be right back.